Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we are talking with Mary Wilson of the Supremes.
Through the mirror of my mind, time after time, I see reflections of you and me. Reflections of the way life used to be. Reflections of the love you took from me. Oh, I'm all alone now. No love to shield me. Trapped in a world that's a distorted reality. Happiness you took from me.
Formed in 1959 as the Primettes, they started out as the companion group to the Primes, who later became the Temptations. But the Supremes broke out to become one of Motown Records' most consistent hit-making acts, scoring more Billboard number one hits than any other vocal group in history. They also left an indelible mark on fashion.
We sat down with Mary, who was a consistent part of the Supremes from its founding until the group's dissolution in 1977. She's also a prolific author. Her latest book, Supreme Glamour, highlights the group's origin story, as well as those iconic costumes. When you think of the Supremes, you think of the songs, but man, those outfits they wore on the Ed Sullivan Show and, you know, Soul Train, amazing. And that is where Jim started our conversation, asking Mary about how their Detroit upbringing impacted their burgeoning fashion sense from a very young age.
A lot of people are not aware because they had this idea about black people not being, you know, fashion type people. But we were in Detroit, Michigan, honey, people dressed up. I mean, the black folks were dressed, all right? And it was so great because, yes, in church is where you really saw, because we didn't have a lot of clubs and things like that. But you really saw how women would come there with their huge hats on, you know, and beautiful high heel shoes and their dresses. So Florence Dionne and I and Betty, our fourth member, all kind of grew up in that environment of our parents, our aunts, and not uncles, but our aunts, you know, and our moms, and all the females were always really dressed well. Plus, they admired some of the black singers and performers who were very big in our black community, maybe not around the world so much. The Lena Horns, you know, Dorothy Dandridge, and we had so many beautiful black females. So we had our eye on those type of women because our parents did. Our moms, they just love and idolize these women. So we grew up with that.
Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together.
Well, Mary, you had also mentioned that you and Diana Ross, your childhood friend, would make a lot of the outfits early on, right? I mean, how did that start? Was that because your moms taught you how to do that, or how did you learn that skill?
Well, we didn't have all the Targets and all the stores, you know, that they have now out there where you can go and buy, you know, things. No, we really had to. My mom was a domestic worker back in the day, and she would bring home sometimes some of the leftovers or handovers from the family that she worked at, the white family she worked in. So, yeah, we learned how to sew. My mom had a little sewing machine, and Diane took sewing in her. She went to a more college preparatory school, and she really had a better idea of sewing than I did. I just learned how to sew, but Diane really learned well. And we would sit there and make some of our short little dresses. We did very early on. I think we really only made one or two, actually.
One of the things that jumped out about the book, Supreme Glamour, that your third book, Mary, is that you talked about the idea that you always wanted to be on that stage, that was the thing that really drew you to it. It wasn't so much about any one particular aspect of it, It was more just being in front of an audience, right? I mean, why? Where did that come from?
Okay, so I let me explain that to you, because early on, it wasn't that I wanted to be a performer, because, you know, we're talking about 19 in the 50s. So black people really were not trying to become stars and things like that back in those days. You know, people were struggling just to be human beings and accepted as a bona fide American citizen. I would wake up singing, and like Sammy Davis used to say, he said he would open up the refrigerator and start, you know, singing. I was that kind of person. I thought everybody in the world woke up singing. Because I'm this very kind of happy person. And it wasn't until I really, rock and roll became very popular back in the early 50s, and I started listening to the music. And then in school, elementary school, we had a contest one year, and I had just seen Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, mm-hmm. and they were singing, "Why Do Birds Sing So Gay?" And anyway, that one, and I'm not a juvenile delinquent, so I went on the show, and I just started pantomiming to their record, and the crowd was saying, "Go Mary, go Mary," and I was like, "Whoa, this feels really good." Now, I'm only 11 or 12 years old, mm-hmm. and on the same show was Florence Ballard. I didn't really know Flo at the time. She just lived in the same project complex as we. And she was singing, Ave Maria. Okay, now we're 11 years old children, you know, young people. And I just admired her voice. I was like, my God, she had such a beautiful voice. And we just started talking. And that's how we actually got together with in this little group, because her sister was dating one of the primes, and they asked Florence if she wanted to sing in this group, and she said, "Yeah, my new friend Mary," and then that's how we met Diane, and you know, we kind of started that way. But I didn't want to become a singer. It wasn't until we put the group together, we started just doing little things around the city, just having fun. We were just having fun. Then we were on shows with other stars who were recording. And we got the idea, well, wow, maybe we should think about recording. So this is when the idea of me wanting to be, you know, on stage and really become a singer. And after that, we auditioned at Motown. Mr. Berry Gordy turned us down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love that story. So for self-empowered, self-assured,
yes.
rather cocky young women.
Yeah, well,
okay,
we were,
you know,
yes.
You thought Berry Gordy ought to be listening to you. And
yeah.
he, like, sends you guys packing, says, come back when you're done with high school.
Mm. Yes, he did. He did. And we were really not happy about this. Okay. We were still about 15 years old. And so I remember walking out the door, Florence said, you can't be that great if they don't know how good we are.
Yeah, I love that.
I mean, because we really, actually, when I look back on it now, 50-some years later, you know, I say we really were, and you said the word cocky, I've never used that one, but anyway, I think we really were, and eventually, we decided to stay there at Motown every day. We'd hang outside the doors, and pretty soon someone came out and said, "We need some hand clappers." We said, "We'll do it." And that's how we got into the doors of Motown. Yeah. And that's how we got in. And it was really at that point, I can finally say that, yeah, I really knew that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So that's when the bug really got me.
You know, you pretty little thing. I really want to be your man.
No, no, no.
So you signed to Motown in 61. You already had a sense of self, Mary. It sounded like you and the fellow ladies mm-hmm. were very self-assured in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a long time by no music hit. Biz terms.
The No Hit
Supremes became...
I made that up.
That was you, right.
Yeah,
I did. And I tell you why. Because, as you mentioned, was that Greg who said that? As you mentioned, we started recording all these little records, and they were by Smokey Robinson. Hey, and we really sounded, we thought, really good, and we were great with harmonies. However, we recorded like, I don't know, 6-7 songs that still had not become hit records. And at the time, you know, everyone at Motown, it was Mary Wells, they were getting hit records and we were not. So we said, listen, you know, we really need a hit. And I remember I thought that maybe people were laughing behind our backs because, you know, we thought we were so good and we still didn't have a hit record and everyone was leaving us behind. So that's when I coined the phrase No Hit Supremes, because I knew they were laughing at us behind our backs and saying, the Supremes think they're so cute, but they don't have a hit record. So that's when Mr. Berry Gordy finally said, I'm going to put you girls with one of my best writing teams and producing teams, Holland Dozier Holland, who most of us know as Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier. Now, let me tell you this story. When we were trying to see what to record, we told Eddie, we said, listen, we got to have a hit record, because if we don't, then our parents are going to make us go to college because they want us to get an education.
Yeah, right.
So we got the hit record. We didn't have to go to college. And that's when the hits started coming. And it was then in 1963 and 1964, we had our first number one million selling records of five consecutives that were, you know, all together to come, which had not been done by anyone, not the Beatles, not Elvis, not anybody who was recording. So we finally had the last laugh, you know, the No Hit Supremes.
The first big song that Holland Dozier Holland wrote for you, Where Did Our Love Go? You tell an interesting story in the book about how you weren't particularly fond of that song initially when you got it presented to you, right?
I know. Because, I mean, it's a good song, obviously, because it was a million seller, right? And people loved it. But we would sing standard material, songs like The Four Freshmen, and you know, we really were great at harmony. And also then all the artists at Motown were more R&B. Well, it ended up that we weren't as R&B as we wanted to be. So we wanted a record that had that more R&B kind of sound. Sort of like Martha and the Vandellas, you know, Dancing in the Street, or the Barbellettes,
more
Please
up-tempo.
Mr. Postman.
Yeah.
And we were kind of square. So our music was square, we thought. And so this record, Where Did Our Love Go, for us seemed just too square. It wasn't R&B. It wasn't soulful like we wanted it to be. So that's why we didn't like it. And so we begged them. And so Eddie Holland said, Mary, trust me, this song is going to be a hit record. Well, hey, he was right. So ever since then, every time I see him, I have to give him a big hug and say, thank you, Eddie.
he was right. Well, and there's that longstanding fallacy out there that the Supremes got Where Did Our Love Go only after the Marvelettes turned it down. Not true, says Mary Wilson.
And it's not true. It's not true. And even I believed it for a while because, you know, I didn't know who they had given a song to. But I when I interviewed people for all of my books, I interviewed Eddie Holland and asked him that question, did you really give this song to, Where Did Our Love Go, to the Marvelettes? And he said, no, Mary, we wrote that song for the Supremes.
Yeah.
So I got the real story.
There you go. Well, we're going to take Mary Wilson's word on that. You know, there's a great story you've told, this notion of, as such young women becoming celebrities, it's a weird thing. And at first, the thing that really hit you is that Hudson's, the famous Detroit department store, would stay open. And this is a place where Diana Ross had worked. They're like, you know, the run of the department store is turned over to you and Flo and Diana.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, as I mentioned early on, it was a time when black people weren't that, you know, popular, let's say. And we would go to stores, shopping stores, and people would follow you around because you were black and they think maybe you were going to steal something.
Set me free, why don't you, babe? Yeah.
you know, now that we became famous and whatever, they would leave some of the stores open. You could tell that America was changing, actually.
And I'm going to tell you about equal opportunity. There was a time when the world was fickle and it may have been hard to succeed. But times have changed now and school and training is all you really need. It doesn't matter who you may be. Everyone's equal with the same opportunity. Yes, things are changing for the better. Things are changing for the better. Now is the time for you to better yourself.
You know, it really was changing, and we were changing as Black people. In terms of the education. See, the education was so important, and our parents would always tell us, make sure you get the education. But I want you to know, I moved to New York back in, I think it was the mid-90s, and I went back and I got my associate's degree from NYU in New York City.
Well, speaking of school, Mary, it sounded like Motown was in many ways like your upper-level education at the time. You went mm-hmm. back to college later, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. as a young woman, mm-hmm. Motown almost like helped that transition from that young, cocky girl group mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. the women who went and represented the world in these glamorous gowns. I think there's a lot of controversy about that, you know, mm-hmm. how controlling Motown was mm-hmm. over its act with the mm-hmm. image and the choreography yeah. and the stage act. How did that play out for you in
real
time?
I'm happy you asked that, but can I actually maybe change a word or two in there? Motown wasn't controlling. Mm-hmm. They actually, and if you look at like the Hollywood system, how they, you know, they groomed their talent, Motown was more of that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what we wanted that. We wanted that because that's what we had in our homes. Our moms and our dads would teach us those kind of things. So now when we were singing, you know, we go into Motown Records, they also had the same type of values as we had. Mr. Berry Gordy's mom and father were one of the Black in the Black community who we would call kind of bougie because they they had a store, you know, then and their daughters went to modeling school. And you had mentioned Maxine Powell, who actually owned the modeling school. Mm-hmm. Now she, at that point, she came to Motown and she started grooming us. And there was in a department called Artist Development. Also, there was Charlie Atkins, who was our choreographer. And people ask about Dancing with the Stars. And, was that hard? It's like, no, we were doing that back at Motown. That's what Charlie Atkins was teaching us. You know, he really was. And if you look at any of those old, and we were on Ed Sullivan's show 16 times, if you look at any of those old clips, you'll see we were doing so many type of dances. Mm-hmm. We were singing the standards that we started before we were even at Motown. So, you know, those were the kind of things you mentioned. I'm glad you said that Motown was. It was like going to college. Mm-hmm. And look at all the people, the shoulders we rubbed shoulders with people, great, talented people. Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, you know, all these great artists, and they were all talented. It was like being at a musical Disneyland, you know, Motown was. And being rubbing shoulders and learning from these great, gifted people, it was college. It was a musical college.
In the book, I'll try my best to get you hooked. Hey, baby.
Take me, I'm yours.
And every night, every day, I'm gonna say, I'm gonna get you, I'm gonna get you. Look out, boy, cause I'm gonna get you. I'm gonna make you love me. Ooh, yes, I will. Yes, I will.
Mary, some of the best photos in Supreme Glamour are mm-hmm. those candid shots mm-hmm. of you and your bandmates, and sometimes mm-hmm. Maxine Powell, of the famous grooming school. You know, in Japan, in the UK, in London, To what extent did it, and when did it dawn on the group that we are not only celebrities now, Hudson stays open for us, but we are ambassadors. We are ambassadors of the African-American community in the United States, of the civil rights movement to the world. Did that hit you? Did the importance of that hit you?
You know, it's amazing. Everyone asked that question. Of course it did. And I say, of course, like that because, you know, and I hate to keep going back to that racial thing, but because black people were not really considered smart or any of those kind of things. So when we became famous and popular around the world, we knew that we had accomplished something that our parents had prepared us for, what Motown had prepared us for, you know, what we had dreamed about ourselves.
As always, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite slice of the Motown sound and why? Leave a message on our hotline with your opinion at 888-859-1800. Coming up, more with Mary Wilson. That's after a break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.